This is Murder Scotland, a podcast that looks at famous and not so famous murders that happened in Scotland or were committed by people with a connection to Scotland. We'll just see how tenuous we can get. My name is Julie Lament. Me and my co-host Alan Nicol will look at these crimes with 21st century eyes and discuss, are they really what we thought they were? Welcome back to Murder Scotland. Where have we been? Where have we been in the last series? We said we would be back in a few weeks and we had these big plans for a whole series around the serial killer Robert Black. And the reality is, when we got into it, the story that we thought was there just wasn't there. So this series is going to be a little bit different. We're looking at several murders and one possible murder. During this series, we're going to look at Robert Black, Sheila Garvey. We're also going to look at Dennis Nielsen and Willie McRae. But the big question mark, was Willie McRae murdered or was it a suicide? So a little bit different from the way we did it previously, but I still think lots of interesting conversation, and Alan and I definitely get into more conversation this series about what it's like for somebody to prosecute and defend people who do heinous crimes. So hopefully you'll find that quite interesting too. This podcast series, we've decided to look at the serial killer Robert Black, who is a renowned paedophile and murderer. And I'm going to say, I never heard of this one until you mentioned it. And I think probably because I was a baby when he committed his crimes. But also, I don't think he's one that's particularly well known. Probably people don't want to remember him or know what his crimes were because, let's face it, he's an evil sack of shit, and I think the world's better off now he's dead.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that, yeah.
But I think one of the things, like when we were talking about discussing Robert Black, one of the things that stood out was that he himself had been abused, and in a sexual manner and in a physical manner as well, and maybe how this had influenced how he himself would become a paedophile. And you said you had some research that you'd read about it.
Yeah. Obviously, there can't be any excuse for the likes of what Robert Black did in his life. But through defending and indeed prosecuting lots and lots of people, the suspicion, the large suspicion that many of us had was that the accused themselves had been sexually abused, and it's a cycle that goes on. According to some research, between a third and three quarters of child sex offenders have been abused themselves.
That's awful.
Certainly know for a fact that every aspect of Robert Black's life has been examined, and there's a very, very good chance that he was abused because he was a foster child.
Yeah, I read that. And it looked like particularly maybe he was abused in two of the homes he was in as well.
Yes. Uh-huh. And he was physically abused as well, because when he was born, his mother didn't want anything to do with him, apparently. In those days, there was a stigma attached to an unmarried mother.
Yeah.
And he was fostered to a family, would you believe, in Kinlochleven, near Glencoe.
Yeah.
And his foster father apparently was pretty hard on him and used to batter him if he did anything wrong.
Jeez.
And of course, from then on, once his foster parents passed away, he was in children's homes. And according to him, anyway, he was sexually abused at that point. So,
oh my God, it's so awful.
It's no excuse. It's definitely no excuse, but it's a possible explanation, I suppose.
So, I've got to ask. I'll just wait till you stop creaking that. How do you defend a pedo? I mean, it's just, it feels like it must be a really, really hard thing to do, to go into court and defend somebody that you, because it must be. And if, as much as you're like, they deserve a fair trial, everybody deserves a fair trial, not like you, I mean, did they, what if somebody told you that they did it? Would you still defend them?
No, the rule, and certainly in Scotland, is that if somebody says to you that they actually committed the crime, you've got two options. You can make the Crown prove it, which is legitimate, and that's okay.
Yeah.
Or you can advise them to plead guilty, whichever's in their best interest. Because by going to trial, you might lose the benefit of a discount for an early plea. If you're convicted of every charge, you then have missed the opportunity to plea bargain and plead to something less than is on the indictment. So, yeah, if somebody tells you they've committed the crime, then the general rule is that you'd get them to plead guilty.
Yeah. And is I'm assuming that's the moral route you took after me giving death stares.
Oh, no. I've defended quite a few people who are charged with paedophile offences.
Jesus.
And they're usually quite persuasive. They're quite charming. They are in complete denial of what they've done. And I think, going back to the other point, was that it's because they don't think they've done anything wrong.
So how did you know that they did it then? Like, just from what came out in the case, or they did in those particular cases, did they tell you that they did it and you just told them to plead?
No, that happens occasionally, but if somebody instructs you to plead not guilty on their behalf,
yeah,
your next question is, so what is your defence to this?
Yeah.
And generally, in cases of sexual abuse of children, the main defence, if it could be called a defence, is that the kids are making up.
Yeah.
And that's just what you put to them, and you say, you've made all this up, you've conspired with this, whatever. That's them. The client might think you're going through the motions, but you're actually testing the Crown case. And of course, anything that crops up that you can explore, that's when you've got to do that, because otherwise you're not giving your client a proper defence.
Do the kids have to go to trial as well? Or is it, do they record it these days? Like, how does that work?
These days, particularly in rape cases, what they do is they take an early video and they get the defence to ask questions on commission, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was defending, that was what, before 2012, there was no such facility, and the kids would have to give evidence.
Jesus, that's awful.
Well, it's maybe...
Come on, imagine being a little kid and sitting in a terrifying courtroom with all these adults asking you questions about that as well.
Yeah, but you've got to remember that the jury are sitting there and there's screens, so the kids can't see anyone. The jury can see them, but the kids themselves are able to relate their story. The judge takes his wig and his gown off. Everyone else does that. So it's meant to be...
It's like a kind of closed court then?
It's a closed court as well, yes.
So there wasn't many people in there.
Aye, there's no onlookers or whatever. So the kid's more at ease. And it's hugely counterproductive for people to shout and bawl or claim, outright that the kids are total liars or whatever. You've just got to play it as straight as you can and let the jury assess it.
Jeez.
And there's no guarantee that they'll convict, because they might see something in their testimony that makes them doubt what the kids are saying. And of course, there are certain evidential rules that the Crown have to follow. So they've got to be similar in circumstances, for instance, the crimes, because there are very few sex crimes, particularly when there's children involved, where there are eyewitnesses.
Yeah.
So it's really just time, character and circumstances.
So if somebody's changing their approach, like, each time because they're, like, getting into a pattern themselves, then there's a chance they could have got away with it.
Yeah, but the people who commit these crimes don't think like that. They tend to assume that they'll never be caught. And they tend to follow the same pattern, tend to say the same things to the victims, the separate victims. And quite often that's really telling, because the victims themselves can give their own evidence, and they sometimes don't even know each other.
Yeah.
Which is really strong evidential link. If somebody has used the same form of words or said the same endearing things to young girls, for instance, then you can imagine that that is a really strong link.
Did you ever defend somebody and they've gone down for the crime and you've been secretly, like, really thrilled because you thought, that's an evil fucker off the street?
Not really, because that's just justice. That's the way it goes. Because in your next case, you might feel totally differently. So you've really got to try and be emotionless about these things. You've really got to.
You just can't have any thoughts about it.
You can't really. If you're going to do your job properly, then you can't be judge and jury, because that's not you. Your job is to represent this person to the best of your ability. And, of course, Joe Public thinks you're a rat for doing it.
Yeah.
And when you're prosecuting a case like that, they think you're a hero because you're prosecuting a case like that. But when you're involved in it, on either side of the table, you've got to just be as professional as you can be.
Yeah. I guess it's a bit like being a surgeon. You just got to put it all to one side, right? You can't think that's a person. Like, you can't think what the focus too much on the crime. You just got to focus on your job and getting it done.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. I suppose the equivalent is like a surgeon realising that the person he's operating on is somebody he's been bullied by at school. He's still got to do his job.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Tempting as it might be to slip.
Do you ever think back and just go, oh, Christ, I've defended some horrific people? And I mean, I think I'd be in therapy.
Well, no, it's different when you're actually in charge of the case, because you then have a duty to the client. And it's actually, once you get into the swing of things, it's quite easy to be as professional as you possibly can be without being insulting to the witnesses or, antagonising the witnesses needlessly, because it is totally counterproductive. If you antagonise kids given evidence, then the jury's going to hate you.
Yeah.
So you've really got to have this very, very thin line to tread. And if you can do that, you're giving your client the best possible chance.
It's making me think about my mum did criminal law for like a very, very brief period.
Uh-huh.
And she had a completely different attitude. She was like, I hate that bastard. I'm never going to defend that guy. He's a pricker.
Yeah.
She got too attached because she'd like some prostitutes that she regularly defended, and she could see them kind of like physically and mentally going downhill over a period of time. And I think she said she just couldn't do it.
She was never cut out for criminal law. Your mother, my sister. And I could tell that from the start, because as soon as she started appearing in court, she would start, she'd phone me up and we'd have a frank discussion about things.
Yeah.
And, I remember one time I went through to Edinburgh and she was on the train and she was involved in a civil case and I was going through for a criminal case. And, we both couldn't understand why, the other enjoyed their aspect of the law.
Yeah.
because I thought that it'd be sheer hell for me to do a civil proof that she loved doing.
Yeah.
And there's no way she could have defended 99% of the people I defended.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, we digress.
Okay.
Back to paedophiles.
Okay, let's start with Robert Black, not just a paedophile, but a murderer. Robert Black was born on the 21st of April 1947 in Falkirk, in the Royal Infirmary, which is in central Scotland. He was born to a 24-year-old factory worker called Jesse Black. Because there was a stigma attached to unmarried mothers, the baby was fostered, and he never knew who his father was, and he did not get to know his mother.
Why was he fostered and not put up for adoption? Is that, I mean, you might not know the answer to that.
I actually don't know the answer to that. You would think so. Maybe she had some thought of
getting him back at some point,
because we do know that Jesse married later, a year later after this, and she had four other children, but they didn't know anything about their brother.
Oh, wow.
Their half-brother, Robert Black. She eventually moved to Australia, and she died in 1987. Black was fostered to a family in Kinlochleven, which is near Glencoe, and very few people actually go through Kinlochleven now, because at one point it was the main route to go north, but when they had a ferry and the bridge at Ballahoolish, it meant that you could cut out 22 miles on the road to Fort William. And he lived in Kinlochleven for his earlier days. Unfortunately, in those days, his foster father beat him when he was bad. And when his foster father died in 1952, his stepmother just took over and beat him as well.
Oh,
because that was the only way they could discipline him.
I read online he was really badly bullied as well, like that he didn't have any personal hygiene, and even when he was like 5 or 6 years old, that the other kids called him smelly Robert Black or something like that, was his nickname.
I think that's right, because he obviously had no personal self-esteem about anything, I don't think.
It was so sad, isn't it? Can you imagine, like, age five, being so, like, depressed that you're not, like, I don't know. I know, like, some wee boys are not super into having a bath or anything like that, but it's sad. It's really sad, especially getting bullied at that age as well.
Yeah, apparently his personal hygiene was something they could have attended better to. But one thing that they did notice about him was that he was totally fascinated, not just by his own anatomy, but by that of little girls as well. And apparently from an early age, he was fairly direct and approaching girls and doing things to himself as well. Is it possible to say what made him into the monster that he became? But when you hear of stories like this, I suppose it's probably right to say that his upbringing was probably something that you would read of in a lot of these sort of situations.
Yeah.
Because it was quite clear that nobody loved them. And I think, just went from bad to worse.
It's awful when it's society's own making, isn't it?
Yeah, you think we could do better these days, but, you know, there are kids growing up all over the country, I suppose, who are probably experiencing something similar.
Yeah.
And, of course, they're the criminals of the future.
Oh, that's so awful. Why did you have to say that? No, that's just not that there's any happiness in this story, but I didn't need to think like that. Just want to feel awful for the poor kids that are growing up in these horrific circumstances.
Well, I suppose we're going in generally the right route, but there's still a huge amount of work to be done.
Yeah.
I think with all the sort of deprived kids that we have in our society. Anyway, after his foster mother passed away, Black was sent to a children's home in Stirlingshire. And this catered for boys and girls. And after that, he was sent to another home in Musselburgh, over on the East Coast, and he stayed there until he was 15, from the age of 11.
All right, okay.
He later claimed to a forensic psychologist after he was arrested that he'd been abused by a male member of staff. The predatory member of staff would select one victim out of all the boys, and then when the boy moved on, the predator would then make the boy select somebody who was to take his place. And apparently Black was selected by somebody who was moving on.
Jesus, why are we doing this? It's so horrible. Oh my God. I mean, I'm like, the fact that I'm feeling sorry for this horrific human being is just like, I don't want to feel sorry for him, but this is so awful.
Well, no matter what happens in a case, when you're involved in a case, usually when you're defending a case, there is a human side to everybody's story.
Yeah.
And that does affect your view of everything, no matter how professional you want to be.
Yeah.
You know, you end up feeling maybe, you know, 1% sorry for somebody, and then doing your best just to ignore that whenever it comes back. Say if they've been convicted and you start thinking, I wonder if I could have done more for that person. I wonder if I was even, you know, swayed by how horrible this crime was.
Yeah.
You've got to really, you know, make sure that doesn't happen to you. Anyway.
So you've got to kind of psychopathically shut down your emotions.
Well,
I'm not calling you a psychopath.
No, but
you kind of have to, right?
There was a study that said that the CEOs of big businesses in America were mostly psychopathic in their approach.
Oh, really?
In that they had no compunction in doing all sorts of horrible things to the opposition. And lawyers came second.
Wow. So, that's crazy. I would have thought doctors and surgeons would be pretty high up that list.
They probably were. But I just remember lawyers coming in a poor second. I expected them to be first. Yeah, whilst he was at this school, him and some other boys at the school tried to rape an 11-year-old girl. But
this is a 15?
He was somewhere between 11 and 15 when this happened.
Oh, my God. He's really starting early.
Well, it started early, all right. Yes. Oh, yes.
I read that the second foster home he was in, there was a sort of perhaps he'd had some inappropriate behaviour towards one of the girls there, and that was part of the reason they chucked him out.
Yes, I think that's right. Because he was moved on from the first home to another home after his foster parents died. And that's a fair point. I wonder why he was fostered rather than adopted.
Yeah, so strange, especially as a little baby.
Yeah, that's something I don't know the answer to.
Well, it might have prevented all of this, right?
It could have, yes. However, when it came to the alleged rape of the 11-year-old girl, apparently no action was taken. Maybe because it was 1958 or thereabouts. When he was 15, he took up employment with a butcher's firm in Greenock in the west of Scotland, and it was then he began molesting young girls. He was a butcher's delivery boy, and what he did was he claimed later on to have molested somewhere between 30 and 40 young girls in the course of his time.
What?
Well, that's what he claimed. How much of that is true, we don't know, because at that point, he probably was trying to con the authorities. But why would he exaggerate these numbers? Maybe he was trying to get some sort of backdoor sympathy, as it were, because he had this runaway problem when he was so young.
I mean, that's the opposite. It's the opposite effect. There's no sympathy. I mean, like, I know you think that I'm, like, quite kind of, I don't know what the word is, woke, because I tend to look at things from, like, quite a modern angle, but not when it comes to these, I think I would be quite happy if they locked people like this up in boxes and let rats gnaw off their testicles.
That's probably the most unwoke thing I think I've ever heard. I spoke to him and he seemed to have opened up to one particularly sort of famous forensic psychologist, and he said that in one of his attacks in Greenock, he said that he and another boy took a young girl into a hut in exchange for cigarettes. He claimed the girl let him see her private parts. Then she smoked the cigarette, and he and the other boy apparently just did nothing to her after that. But when he was 16, it could be verified that he was actually an offender, because he had gone to a swing park, and this was a court case. He was 16, it was 1963, and in the swing park there were children playing, and he waited till all of them, apart from one little girl, had gone home. He then went over to the girl. It was later established she was only 7, and he pushed her in the swing for a while, then told her that he knew where there were kittens and she could see them. So he took her into an old abandoned air raid shelter. He throttled her until she passed out. Then he removed her underwear, sexually assaulted her, and then left her for dead. So this was an early warning of the way this man was going to be when he was older.
How did he not end up in, like, prison for his whole life for that?
Well, this is one of the strange aspects of his story, because when the case went to court in Greenock, he was given a 12-month deferred sentence.
What?
He got 12 months to behave himself at Greenock Sheriff Court in June 1963. There was a psychiatric report which claimed the offence was a one-off situation.
A one-off situation? Strangling a young girl unconscious and sexually assaulting her?
Yes.
What the fuck goes through these people's minds? This is in the 1960s, it's just everyone doing it. What?
I don't think everyone was doing stuff like that, but this was the first time he had actually come to the proper authorities' notice. And the psychiatric report, as I say, was completely off beam, because it said he was unlikely to offend again. He was forced to leave Greenock at that point, and he got a job as a delivery driver with John Mingus. And
see, if that happened today, that was like, people would realise, I mean, obviously he'd get a sentence today, right? This is in the 60s. But would they be put on a list? I mean, they would. They'd be put on a sex offenders register, right?
In 1963, no. But now, nowadays, yes, there is a sex offenders register.
Right, okay.
However, he got this other job in Grangemouth. Even though he didn't have a driving licence, he got a job driving. And he ended up, when he was, I think, 17, he met a woman called Pamela. And this was the only time it's been recorded where he had a what's called a normal relationship with a woman.
With an adult.
With an adult woman, yes. And apparently he just expected them to carry on seeing each other, to get married and all the rest of it. But then he apparently took it really badly when she ended it all by sending him a letter.
That's interesting, because have you ever read about the Happy Face murderer in the States? When he was like happily married, he stopped murdering. But then when he split up with his wife, that's when he got back into it again. I wonder how often that happens.
It's like a security, emotional security thing for him, because later on, when he was charged with the murder of three young girls, apparently the latest study on him says that this was like 30 years later. He apparently said to the police that this was 30 years after Pamela had split up from him. Tell Pamela she's not responsible for this.
She would never have thought she's responsible. She was no way responsible for this sex son of a bitch's twisted mind.
Uh-huh.
What the absolute shit. So he's trying to gaslight somebody. What?
Well, you know, maybe that's worth thinking about, because he, in a link in his head, probably, you know, when he said, tell Pamela she's not responsible for this, maybe that was genuine. Maybe he genuinely thought that had he stayed with her, had they got married, he could have possibly, you know, got himself straightened out. I think that was the general view.
I don't think we can rationalise what this guy's
thinking.
Right.
No, you're probably right.
This could be another just sick, twisted little game from, you know, she maybe is living a happy life, completely forgotten about this prick. Mm-hmm. And he's just dragging her name up, bringing her into his walk of shame. Holy shit.
Yeah, I think there may be something in that, that he's just trying to blame her by a sort of devious route.
Yeah.
You know, by making out that because he was dumped 30 years before, he was trying to blame her.
Yeah, but I mean, as we've established, I'm not woke when it comes to
I see that, yes, I'm getting that impression.
So I'm going to think everything he does do is evil.
Like, yeah.
Full stop.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. He was eventually convicted of all three murders in 1994. And in 2011, he was convicted of a fourth killing of a 9-year-old girl in Northern Ireland. Now, Black died in prison in Northern Ireland in 2016, aged 68.
Was that a slow and painful death? Please tell me it was.
I would try and couch this in woke terms just to please you, but no, I think it was a sudden heart attack.
Oh, damn it.
I'm sorry about that. I can change that a bit if you want. Perhaps
just rats came into his room in the middle of the night.
That definitely
gnawed his
happened.
Testicles
yes.
off.
Yes,
good.
Yes.
That's what I was hoping for.
I think the duty rats were employed by the prison. Mind you, the real starting point in Black's story was what happened in the village of Stow in the Scottish borders in July 1990. Now, people call it Stow, but it's actually Stow, is how you say it. In July 1990, he was working for a postal delivery company called PDS and was on the road between Edinburgh and Galla Shields. Whilst driving through Stow, he spotted a young girl. She was walking in her own. She had a dog. And he drove on, then turned the van round and came back through the village again. When he next saw the girl, he stopped the van, got out, and asked if there was a cafe in the village. She had no idea what his intention was, so she gave him directions. But as she did so, her dog, which was a golden retriever, that started barking at him. So he gave up the idea of seizing hold of her. And there was somebody further along the street, a man working in his car. So Black got back into the van and drove off. He went to the cafe, he had something to eat, and when he was going back through the village, he spotted a six-year-old girl walking on her own. And once again, he drove out the village, turned the van around, and came back in. When he came back into the village, she had disappeared, having gone into a friend's house. And then when he turned the van round again, this time he spotted her as she walked along the pavement. He pretended he was cleaning his windscreen and he stopped the vehicle, pulled the van in so that if she was walking along the pavement, she'd have to walk by the van by squeezing herself against a wall and the vehicle, and he'd opened the passenger side door. As she walked by, he scooped her up and he threw her into the passenger seat and then warned her to keep quiet before pushing her onto the footwell under the dashboard. He then got into the van and drove out the village, thinking no one had seen him. However, as I say, this is the best part of the story. He was wrong.
Yeah, this is how he got caught.
This is how he was caught for everything. From that point on, he was never free again. Excuse me. A neighbour of the little girls, a retired postmaster, called David Herkes, had been out cutting his grass, and because Mr. Herkes was below the level of the road, which was the A7 from Edinburgh to Galla, he had noticed that the girl walking along the pavement, and then he'd seen Black's van pulling up, and eventually, you know, effectively it blocked her way. Mr. Herkes had stop cutting the grass because something had jammed the roller in the lawnmower and the blades weren't going round. He had noticed two pairs of feet, Black's and the little girl's, but when he looked up again, he only saw Black's. He then saw Black pushing something into the van, which then took off. Mr. Herkes then took a note of the van's registration number, and then he ran to the little girl's house because he knew who she was, and he told the mother what he'd seen.
Oh my God, Mr. Herkes is amazing.
He was lauded as the hero of all this because...
how many people would notice all that and think to take down the registration number? It's amazing.
Well... You know, you'd imagine that Mr. Herkes maybe had some sort of law enforcement background, but he didn't. He was a retired postmaster, and he knew everybody in the village, is probably still the case. So he went to the woman's house and he told her what he'd seen. And at that point, the police were called. Now, one of the great ironies of the story was that the young girl's father was a police officer. He was in Kelso at the time, which isn't too far away. And when the police were called, there were five panda cars appeared. You know, that's what they used to call police vans. And what happened was he was standing out in the street talking to the police and saying, I've got the registration of the van. It was a blue Ford Transit. And the police were, putting out calls to stop this van, because it was quite clear the wee girl had been abducted. And what Black did was he drove north. He had a delivery to make in Gala, which is south of Stow.
Yeah.
But he had driven north because he knew there was a lay-by there. And he drove north, realising he'd have to go back through Stow to get to Gala on the A7. He stopped in the lay-by. He asked the girl what her name was. He then took her into the back of the van, where he tied her hands behind her back. He tied up her legs. He put a plaster on her mouth. And then he removed her shoes and socks and put a pillow over her head, like a hood. And then he began sexually assaulting her. Once he had done that for a wee while, he then put her into a sleeping bag. At that point, because his last delivery was in Gala, and thank goodness it was, he then drove back through Stow, at which point the little girl's father was one of the police officers standing there. And as the van approached the police...
Did he know it was... I mean, he must have known it was his daughter, right, that they were looking for?
Oh, he did. Oh,
and they were still, like, allowing him to sort of go about his police duty, or I guess he's just... Like, would they not have taken him off duty and made him go home and wait? No, I guess not.
I wouldn't think so, because he's another man. So, it's going to be handy if there's a big inquiry.
I know, but like, what if it was me and I pulled him over? I would have gone at him with a baseball bat. Do you know what I mean? Some people...
Well, he reacted, but he didn't knee anybody in the ghoulies, as woke people tend to do.
Yeah.
And he didn't have any baseball bat on him, because he wasn't from Paisley. That was just a joke, incidentally. And what happened was Mr. Herkes saw the van coming towards him and said, "That's him, that's the van."
Wow.
And at that point, the girl's father stepped out onto the roadway, and he stood in front of the vehicle, and the vehicle slewed to a stop and went to the right. And the next thing, the police had him taken out of the front of the car, and the father went to the back of the van, and whilst other officers were handcuffing Black, the dad opened the back of the van and called his daughter's name. There was no answer. And what he did was he noticed that some of the rubbish, the van was full of rubbish.
Yeah.
He noticed that some of the rubbish had moved, and it looked as if there was something inside the sleeping bag. So he opened the sleeping bag, and he thought it was a bundle of rags, and he quickly discovered his own daughter in it.
Was she alive? Why is this, like, what's this dramatic pause for? Was she alive?
I'll come to that. I'll come to that. What he did was he got the girl out. He shouted at Black. This is the official version. That's my daughter, you bastard. Whether he need him in the ghoulies is just,
I mean, I'm just going to assume all of the police just, like, let him do whatever he wanted, and good for them. It's the one time I'll accept police brutality situation. Right.
Okay. Apparently, she was within about 15 minutes of suffocating, because she had her mouth taped. She was inside a sleeping bag. She had a pillow over her head.
Oh, my God.
And she, they say maybe 10 to 15 minutes should have lasted in the back of this
van. Wow, so she was alive.
She was alive. And Black was taken to Selkirk Police Office. On the way, he started concocting his defence, and he said that he had just succumbed to this crazy notion. He was going to keep her for a wee while, and then he was going to take her somewhere like, say, Blackpool, and then let her go. But the big question is, for everyone looking back at this incident, what if Mr. Herky's lawnmower hadn't snagged?
Yeah.
This guy would have got away with it.
Let's face it, she would be dead, wouldn't she? Herky's was, he was the saviour.
Oh, undoubtedly, yes. His actions were spot on.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had actually not just brought this abduction to the authorities' attention, but he had actually solved 4 murders, as it turns out.
Yeah.
Of other little girls who had suffocated because it was the same sort of method. The police weren't too impressed with his story that it was just a one-off thing and he had succumbed to this crazy notion to snatch a little girl off the street. And I actually checked his van and they found that he had actually got an abduction kit in the van. He had a mattress, he had rope, he had sticking plaster, he had hoods, he had a dildo, he had lubrication, and he had girls' clothing. And apparently he dressed up in girls' clothing when he was off duty.
Wow.
Which is a real strange one. So they searched his flat in London and they found pornographic books and videos featuring the sexual abuse of children.
Jesus Christ.
They also found a semen-stained newspaper that contained a report of an attempted abduction of a girl in Nottingham. And he was later charged with that as well.
Yeah.
So the fact it was semen-stained suggests that he enjoyed that story to the extent that he masturbated.
We got the gist.
Okay, I'll stop the details there.
So do you think he only did there was more than 4 maybe? Because that's, like, if he's got a planned out kit, that feels like he's maybe, I don't know, that just feels like he's very organised and prepared. And we know that he's been doing this since he was like 16. And how old is he now at this point?
47 he was born.
Wow.
So in 1990 he'd be 43.
And he's been doing it since he was 16.
Uh-huh.
So do you think there's more than 4?
Well, they look back on it, and this is what always happens with a serial killer. The press always have hundreds and hundreds.
Yeah.
And there are about another 10 that they've investigated.
Wow.
But that's what makes this inquiry so interesting, because they were able to tie in the other murders, the other 3. Because the little girl survived this one.
God, she's like the same age as my sister. There's a woman walking around potentially Scotland that lived through this, whose parents are still probably still alive, that mm-hmm. lived through this.
Yeah.
My God, imagine that. It's like your life story. Holy cow. I mean, obviously you'd have like a bigger life beyond that, but Jesus, the amount of therapy you'd need to have mm-hmm. gone through that. Mm-hmm. What? That is insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really remarkable story, and it was just by chance that a very alert member of the public got him.
Yeah.
Because without that, who knows, he could have carried on and died and never been caught.
Yeah.
So it was just as well Mr. Herky's was on alert. He was in court from the case from Stow in August of 1990, and he pleaded guilty to the abduction and sexual assault of the 6-year-old girl. And he was sentenced to life imprisonment by Lord Ross, who was a Lord Justice Clerk. The psychiatric report that was prepared for that hearing stated that Black was and would be a grave danger to young girls. He instructed his counsel to say that the incident was an isolated one and that he was not a danger to children. By that time, the police forces involved were investigating the murders of three other girls that had started their inquiries. It was to be a long haul, as there were no physical links connecting Black to any of the crimes. They contacted the firm PDS, and that's the firm that Black worked for, between 1976 and 1990, so they could work out where he had been and what girls had been abducted during those years. Eventually, the investigation was presented with 22 tonnes of material that had to be gone through and 7 million credit card slips to try and work out where Black had been.
Holy shit.
So it took a wee while. They investigated the murders of the three girls and the attempted abduction of a girl from Nottingham. And they managed to check out his movements the whole time.
So I guess it could have been more, but it's just like those were the easiest ones to connect to him.
Yeah, because by that time there had been murders, that of little girls who had been murdered and dumped. In 1990, as I say, Lord Ross gave him a life, despite the fact he was pretending it was just a one-off situation, it was an impulse, all the rest of it. But by that time, they had various murders. There was an 11-year-old girl called Susan Clare Maxwell. She lived in Cornhill and Tweed, which is on the borders. And at that time, she'd been playing tennis in Coldstream, which is just on the Scottish side of the border.
Yeah.
She disappeared, as I say, in July of 1982. Her body was found on the 12th of August in Uttoxeter in England. And at that point, the police had worked out that the person who had picked her up or abducted her was probably a traveller of some sort, a sales rep or whatever. The next one was in July 1983. A 5-year-old girl called Carolyn Hogg was abducted, and she was murdered after she was playing near her home in Portobello in Edinburgh. She'd walked to a fairground, and witnesses had actually seen her with a man. He was holding her hand, and he'd taken her to the fairground. Her body was found in Leicestershire, near to the M1. Again, they figured it was somebody who was on the road.
Yeah.
And, of course, they tied up the Susan Maxwell case with that of Carolyn Hogg. 111, 15.
So horrible.
Isn't it? 1986, March 86, a 10-year-old girl called Sarah Harper was abducted from near her home in Leeds, in Morley in Leeds. And what had happened on this occasion was, Sarah had gone into a shop, and a man who was balding had come into the shop. He had walked around the shop, he'd bought nothing, and he left as soon as the girl left. And her body was found on the 19th of April 1986. Her body was found in the River Trent, and they wondered if she had drowned. And what makes this even more distressing, if that's possible, is that this young girl had horrific internal injuries after she'd been sexually assaulted. So he had really tortured her. Another one that he was involved in was in April 1988, 2 years after the previous one. There was a girl who was called Teresa Thornhill. She was 15, but apparently she looked much younger because at 15, she was probably a bit old for black. She'd spoken to somebody who was a friend of hers, and then she'd walked some distance and then started screaming because black tried to seize her. The boy who she was with ran back, and apparently black jumped into his car or his van and drove off. And they were unable to get the registration of the car, of the van.
God, so she's a lucky escape.
She had a really lucky escape. But he was convicted of these murders and the attempted abduction of the girl in Nottingham. But surprisingly, perhaps, the first murder he was proven to have committed was that of a girl called Jennifer Cardy. She was 9. She was abducted, sexually assaulted and murdered in August 1981. She was last seen by her mother as she cycled to a friend's house in Ballanderry in County Antrim in Northern Ireland.
Is that why he ended up in prison in Northern Ireland?
Yes, that's right, because even though this was the very first one they could show, they had to wait until he was convicted of the others, and then they pieced the case against him, because they pieced that together because they had all this information about where he had been. They were able to do that from petrol receipts, and they eventually, once he had been convicted of the murders, they were able to build up a case against Black at that point. This little girl's body was found in a reservoir in Hillsborough, which was near to where she stayed. And apparently some pathologist at the trial had noticed signs of sexual abuse on the girl's body, and they decided she'd actually died of drowning. Although she'd been, there'd been a ligature put round her neck. And they reckoned that whoever had done this knew the way around Northern Ireland. Of course, Black had worked in Northern Ireland before. He got a special payment for going there because it was during the times of the Troubles. And in 2009, he appeared at Armagh Crown Court in Northern Ireland in relation to the murder of Jennifer Cardy. The case against him was proved by what they call in England and in Northern Ireland, it's similar to something that we have in this country, but it's in Scotland, but it's more far-reaching. It's called similar fact evidence. And what they do is they compare previous cases that he has been convicted of.
Yeah.
And they compare them, the facts, to that of the case they're trying to prove. In a way, you've got to think it's slightly unfair, because when the jury hear that this guy's been convicted of 3 murders,
they're obviously going to be biased.
Yeah. I would imagine so.
Yeah.
I would imagine the first thing you think is, this is a guilty so-and-so.
But I mean, if he's been, I don't know. I can't keep an open mind about this one. I just, I was going to say, if you've been convicted of 3, you've done the other ones, right? Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's the sort of general view of these situations, that if you're allowed to lead evidence of previous convictions, which you wouldn't be in this country.
No.
In Scotland. But they're allowed to do that. And there were similarities, obviously, with the Jennifer Cardy case and that of the other girls who disappeared down the years. So the jury obviously convicted again of Jennifer Cardy, the murder there. In this instance, the went through all the petrol receipts again. And this occasion, there were over 500,000 they had to check.
Jeez,
which
wow.
must have taken a while. They found out that, in fact, he had been paid extra to do the Northern Ireland trip. And he was in Northern Ireland on the day of the murder. Apparently, he began by admitting he'd been in Northern Ireland on the day.
Really? So he was quite open about it.
He said, I probably was, yeah. And, you know, with similar fact evidence, then he was going to get convicted.
Yeah.
Which is fair enough if that's, you know, the law at the time.
You're just not going to criticise the law even though you don't think it's right.
No. As I say, it wouldn't happen in Scotland, I don't think. Don't think you'd be allowed to lead evidence of previous convictions, even though they're similar fact.
Seeing these kind of things, though, where there's, like, people have repeated behaviours.
Uh-huh.
I mean, do you not think it does kind of have a... Like, I know what you're saying. It does completely and utterly bias anyone that's going to be listening to it, but... I mean, surely it must count for something if somebody's repeated sexual assault crimes that they've committed in a similar manner that they're not allowed to bring that up. You don't think that's a bit?
I think the closest we get to that in Scotland is the Muirhoff Doctrine, whereby you can prove similar facts, and you can say that. All the cases are corroborated by each other, as it were, because they're related in time, character and circumstances. Sometimes you even have dockets at the end of charges which say that the Crown are going to lead the following, and they will say that without seeking a conviction. A docket doesn't mean you're convicted of it, but they will say that they're going to lead this evidence on the basis that it'll corroborate something
else.
Similar.
Yeah.
We're getting towards this route.
Yeah.
But in Northern Ireland and in England, it seems to be the done thing that you can lead evidence of similar fact convictions.
Wow.
And as we agreed, if you're on the jury, you're going to say, this man's already murdered three little girls and tried to abduct a fourth.
Yeah.
You know, you're gonna not like him, you know.
Yeah, but, I mean, if he's already murdered three people, well, yeah. He's done it, hasn't he? Let's just face it. He's done it. I get what you're saying. He's never going to get a fair trial, but
mm-hmm.
he has done it. We know he's done it. If somebody's even done two previous that he's been convicted of, he's done it.
Yeah. What if he hadn't done it?
You're such a lawyer. Like, I guess you could get copycat person, couldn't you?
Yeah.
You could,
uh-huh,
yeah.
Uh-huh. If he was innocent of these murders and he was only convicted because he'd already attempted to abduct the girl in Stow, then it may be that somebody else is free who should have been convicted.
Who did it? Yeah, no, I get it. I get what you're saying. But I still think he should have a slow and painful death.
Right, so you get what I'm saying.
An unfair trial.
But you've got no sympathy. Okay.
I've got no sympathy for him. One of those girls was five. That doesn't take away from any of the other ones. One of them was five.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I spent the morning in my son's childcare with girls the same age, and it just, the idea that anybody could hurt one of them or take one of them or just, it's horrific. It's like, I can't even speak. I really hope that there is an afterlife and that he is roasting over Satan's fire right now getting his testicles gnawed off by rats.
Right. You seem to concentrate on his testicles quite a lot here.
Yeah, because he used them for such crimes during his lifetime. Mm-hmm. I hope that all the crimes that he committed on other people are getting played over on him on a daily basis in a mythical afterlife.
Yeah, but that's a totally different question. That's whether we believe in an afterlife.
And I don't know that I do, but I want to for this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I take it he's not in heaven, he's in hell.
Of course he's in heaven. What planet are you on that he'd be in heaven?
Right. Okay, I can reverse this question. What planet are you on if you believe in heaven?
I didn't say I believe in it. I said I want to believe in it.
You want to believe in it, okay.
Yes.
Okay, I've got that.
So that was the horrible story of Robert Black. We chose that story because we thought there was a mystery around some other murders that happened in Scotland, and we thought there was a possibility Robert Black was involved, but unfortunately it just wasn't the case. The police have absolute records of everywhere that Robert Black was, because he was quite detailed about keeping receipts and the company he worked for tracked him quite heavily. So let's all collectively forget his name, because he does not deserve to have his name remembered, and talk about next week. So next week, the podcast is about Sheila Garvey, whose husband was murdered, and there's a bit of a question mark about whether or not she was involved with that. And Alan literally wrote a book about Sheila Garvey. So it's going to be a two-parter, because we've got a lot of information to get through. The first part is going to go through the crime, and the second part is going to go through the trial. If you like our podcast, then please like and share with your friends. We would love to hear your feedback and ideas on Twitter at Murder Scotland. If you'd like any more information on our sources or Alan's books, you can find us at www.murderscotland.com. Murder Scotland is written, presented and produced by Alan Nicol. Presented, produced and edited by me, Julie Lamont. Our consulting producer is Paige Henderson. Music is called Moments by Adrian Walther. And a special thanks to Steve Garside and Miriam Watson for their unending support and patience with me and Alan.